You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, dear.
I almost got stuck in there.
You did pretty good. You go get some rest, because tomorrow's your day, okay?
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'll come tuck you in later.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, don't go away. We have a special guest tonight, and we're going to be talking about something that most America has never heard of and doesn't, let me put it this way, probably won't understand it when they do. But we're going to try to get it across as well as we can. On the other end of the phone here, we have Larry Beecraft, one of the preeminent lawyers in this country, and he might argue that point, but within my circle of friends, he certainly is famous. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Country road on the wind, it comes to call. And it sings in the farms and the factory towns, and where you think there'd be no song at all. And the words are the words that our fathers heard as they whistled down the years. And the name of the song is the name of the tree, and it's music to our ears. America, America.
Beecraft, welcome to the Hour of the Time.
Oh, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, and I'm so happy to have you as my guest tonight.
Pleasure.
We're going to talk about something that you sent to me a couple of weeks ago, and I've had a little time to look over it, and also that there's a book that you want to talk about that's written by the lead counsel in this action, Dr. William F. Pepper from London, England. And the other attorney who's involved here is Wayne Chastain of Memphis, Tennessee, who's associate counsel, and they are both working on behalf of James Earl Ray, who is suing Lloyd Jowers, Raoul, and other unknown co-conspirators. This name Raoul keeps popping up all over the place and has for quite some time in some of the more despicable acts of the intelligence community, and in particular the Central Intelligence Agency. Do you want to start out and tell us what this suit is all about, Larry?
Pat Shannon is a friend of mine. He was telling me about 2 or 3 months ago about this lawsuit that had been filed in Memphis. And it was some lawyers that were suing on behalf of James Earl Ray, some people that had set him up for the murder of Martin Luther King. I happened to, after Bill Patch told me this bit of information, I happened to be meeting a client over in Memphis back the first May or so. So I went over there and I had twofold purpose. One, to talk with my client. That's a criminal conspiracy case. But after we got through talking, I told my client we needed to run downtown to the Shelby County Courthouse. So I went down there, and before I went, I called Wayne Chastain to get the case number for this particular case, and he gave it to me over the phone. And I went down to the Shelby County Clerk's office in downtown Memphis, Tennessee, and pulled the file, and sure enough, there it was. And you open it up, and the complaint is on top, and all the other pleadings are down below it. And sure enough, there is this lawsuit filed back in August of 94, whereby James Earl Ray is suing this fellow by the name of Lloyd Jowers, and another party that's named in the case is Raoul Blank. And that Blank is there for a very specific reason. But sure enough, there is a lawsuit that's been filed, and sure enough, James Earl Ray is being represented by these two lawyers, and sure enough, Lloyd Jowers has been sued, and sure enough, Raoul Blank has been sued. And Raoul Blank has even gone out and got a lawyer to defend him. Raoul Blank. And you can see, that I keep saying Blank, and maybe our listeners probably don't understand why I'm saying that. That's not his last name, B-L-A-N-K. When you take a look at the face of the complaint, it's got Raoul, and then it's got a long line there. And that's an empty space for his last name. And when the lawsuit was filed, they didn't have conclusive proof about what his last name was, but since that time, they know who he is. But still, nonetheless, none of the parties involved in the case has stepped forward and inserted for the public record his true name. You know, they're still keeping it hidden. I guess there's a gentleman's agreement among the plaintiff and the defense not to reveal at this time who he is. So his lawyer even files pleadings on behalf of this defendant in this case, and the lawyer files it. You know, this is a brief on behalf of Raoul Blank, last name unrevealed at the present time.
I had never seen that before in my life, and when I was reading through the response of Raoul Blank, I was amazed to find that indeed in his response, every time his name is listed in this response, his last name is not.
Yes, and Raoul knows that Pepper and James Earl Ray know who he is because they went to his house and had him served with the lawsuit. So Raoul knows that they know. And apparently there's, you know, while I haven't checked this out and confirmed it for myself, the only thing that you can conclude by looking at the file is the fact that there must, in fact, for whatever reason, you know, we're not privy to the reason why, but it's quite obvious that all the parties are agreeing that at the present moment they will still continue referring to this this individual unknown to us but known to the parties. They'll continue referring to him as Raoul Blank.
Well, I think I have a suspicion as to why Raoul Blank doesn't want his last name known. He was implicated in the Kennedy assassination and many other despicable deeds, and people have been looking for him for many years. And this is the first time that I've had any indication that anybody knew who he was.
Oh, wait, they certainly, Pepper found out about it. Let me tell you a little bit about Pepper.
Okay.
He, you know, if you read his book, he came out with a book recently called, it obviously could have come off the press as soon as last November, I would think. So it's a book that's hot off the press. The ink's just barely dry on the pages. William F. Pepper is a man, I would gauge his age to be about 55, maybe 60. But he was prominent back during the Civil Rights era. And if you read his book called Orders to Kill, he's got pictures in the middle of his book, and it shows him walking with Martin Luther King during a lot of the Civil Rights protests and things of that nature. So here you have a man that is at least coming from the liberal side of the political spectrum. And he was closely associated with the Martin Luther King camp. And I have always thought that, at least from the official line that was promoted by the King camp, that the King people probably accepted the party line about the manner and means of the death of Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what I lived under that presumption for a long time, primarily because maybe race was a factor in this, at least in the relationship, the claimed relationship between James Earl Ray and Martin Luther King. But, here you have this William F. Pepper fellow, who is an international lawyer. He comes from the Northeast, but he's a lawyer, and he's really practicing international law, so he maintains an office in London. But I was fascinated that somebody in that camp, a man of that caliber, would ultimately decide to go meet the man who had pled guilty to pulling the trigger and assassinating Martin Luther King. But in any event, that happened. And Pepper, when he went to see James Earl Ray in jail, was accompanied by several prominent civil rights leaders. And after that meeting, they came away with the firm, they were convinced, they had a firm conviction that James was innocent. Now, subsequent to that meeting, let's change the scenario a little bit. Let's move a little bit forward into time and deal with another Patriot individual. Do you ever remember a man by the name of Tupper Saucy? You ever heard the name?
Yes, I did. I've heard the name. I don't know the person.
Okay. Tupper was a playwright, an author, an advertising executive from Nashville, Tennessee. And back in the 60s and 70s, that's where he was living. But about 76 or 77, he left Nashville, he and his wife, Freddie, and they moved up to Suwanee, Tennessee, and Tupper was beginning to get into, the Patriot movement at that time. And of course, he filed for 77, 78, and 79, he filed this amendment to income tax return. So, it's clear that by the time that Tupper moved to Suwanee, that he was clearly deeply involved in the Patriot movement. But Tupper, back starting about 1980, he wrote a little book called Miracle on Main Street. And that was a very simple book, yet it was written in such a manner that when people would read it, it would turn them into wild advocates for the Constitution. The book was about Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution, which says no state shall make anything other than gold and silver coin, a tender and payment of debts. That's what it was about, the money issue.
Uh-huh.
But, it was written so well that, I could give that book to people on one evening, and they wouldn't know anything about this issue. They would be paper money advocates and everything else like that. But the following morning, I would talk to them, and after they'd read the book, and they said, wow, they were turned on. So, that's the type of individual that Tupper was. He was having a lot of conventions in Suwanee, Tennessee back in the early 80s, and as a consequence, the Federales had their attention drawn to him. And so by 1985, the feds turned around and they charged Tupper with the crimes of willful failure to file income tax returns for 78, 79, and 80. And that case is unique in and of itself. But I got a neighbor of mine coming over here right now. I'm standing out with. I hope your listeners don't mind the interruption here. I'm standing out on the back porch here, Harper was prosecuted by the feds for the crime of willful failure to file, and one of the things that he pulled was a series of stunts during the course of his case. He would do things like, to get himself thrown in jail for contempt. And one of Tennessee's most prominent inmates in the Tennessee penal system was James Earl Ray. And, of course, Tupper's case was going on down in Chattanooga and Brushy Mountain, where James was located, is in the vicinity of Chattanooga. So James became aware of the existence of Tupper Saucy. So sometime about late 85, James sent his manuscript to Tupper and said, hey, look, this is my story. I want it published. And he had a lot of confidence in Tupper's writing capabilities and stuff like that. So, my personal opinion is that that was a good selection, a good choice on James' part. And so Tupper started to work, and he polished up James' manuscript. And he ultimately published by, the early part of 1986, he had published James' book, and the name of that book was called Tennessee Waltz. In that book, from James' viewpoint, this is the way the events transpired. James was just a penny-ante thief. He was back in about 67, he was in prison in Missouri for some petty offense. I think it was burglary or larceny or something like that. Just a property offense.
Mm-hmm.
And then he broke out of jail. And he ultimately worked his way up to Montreal, Canada. And there he met a shady fellow by the name of Raoul. And Raoul proposed to him. Raoul came to learn that James was, during that conversation, the meeting in that bar, he came to learn that James was an escaped felon, and he was looking for money to get out of the country. Well, if you want somebody to totally keep under your control, if you want somebody that's almost a slave, I would suggest that you would become friends with somebody that recently escaped from jail. They need you, right?
Sure.
Okay. Well, that's what Raoul did. Raoul employed James. And, of course, James was sent all around the country by Raoul. They sent him out to the West Coast, sent him down to New Orleans, always to do something about gun running. Well, according to James, the way he got set up was Raoul, right back in, late March or early April of 1968, Martin Luther King was killed, as I recall, April 4th of 68. So somewhere, within 5 or 6 days of that, Raoul and James were in Birmingham, Alabama. And Raoul had James go to a place called the Arrow Marine Supply, which was a gun dealer. That's a kind of an odd name for a gun dealer, but nonetheless, that was a name. He sent James over there to buy a gun. James bought the gun, brought it back to Raoul. And, of course, Raoul is going to be displeased with it because what he's wanting to do is he's wanting to gun seller to recall specifically that James bought the gun. And the way you would do that is to make sure that the gun owner had a reason to recall James. So Raoul, once James got back the gun that Raoul had really selected, Raoul says, no, I don't want that gun. Take it back and get another one. Well, there you have the events orchestrated in such fashion so that...
And to the gun dealer, it was an offense.
Oh.
And to the gun dealer, it was an offense.
Right. Well, not an offense, but an event that you would recall. It was extraordinary, out of the ordinary. And so, that's what happened. Well, the next thing, Raoul moves on over to Memphis without James, and James takes about 4 or 5 days to fly from Birmingham to Memphis. But he nonetheless gets there about 2 days before the King assassination is scheduled to go off. And on the day of the assassination, James met Raoul. The Lorraine Motel is south of downtown Memphis. The physical setting around it is that in the vicinity of, within eyeshot of the Lorraine Motel is the backside of a row of buildings in which there's one business establishment called Jim's Grill. And next to Jim's Grill is a real cheap boarding house.
Uh-huh.
So James was supposed to meet Raul at Jim's Grill and bring in the gun. And, of course, he did that. And then Raul told him to go upstairs to the boarding house and rent a room under a certain name. And that happened. And after all those things happened, you know, James was told to, you know, kill some time. So he did. And James's position is that, you know, he was out, he went to a gas station to get his a leaky tire fixed. And when he came back to meet Raul at his Jim's Grill, he saw a bunch of cops standing around. So, you know, here he is, a fleeing felon. And he thought the best thing to do was to leave the scene. And while he was doing that, within a short time while he was driving south out of Memphis, he heard that Martin Luther King had been assassinated at the Lorraine Motel. And that's when he begins to conclude that, hey, I think I've been set up. So to make a long story short, Ray went over to Atlanta, then ultimately went up to into Canada, worked his way over to England. Of course, he was arrested in England and extradited back to the United States. James's James, when he was brought back into Tennessee to stand charges for the murder of King, he retained a lawyer in Birmingham by the name of Art Haynes. And Art Haynes is a good lawyer, you know, back in those days. You know, he's I know he's retired now, but he was one of Alabama's prominent attorneys back then. But Art Haynes was going to take the case to trial, but right shortly before the trial was to start, James was convinced to drop Haynes and bring in the lawyer that he had that ultimately persuaded him to plead guilty. And so James, in essence, contends that he was set up to enter a guilty plea to the murder of King. And of course his position was, hey, I'm forced into do this, I'll just plead guilty, and then a couple of days later I'll start attacking the plea. And that's what he did. So, you know, it's quite obvious that James, in reference to his plea, had a different strategy other than what he's being forced to by his lawyer. Well, you know, that's all that James knew. And you know, there were a lot of suspicious circumstances regarding the state's case. The state's chief witness against James was a guy that was supposed to be drunk at the time of the King assassination.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just on analysis of the state's case, you can see that there's some real big holes in it. Now, after Tupper had finished and published James's book under the title of Tennessee Waltz, that was about the time that, you know, Tupper had been tried and he had been convicted on one of his income tax counts, and he was convicted on one out of three counts. He appealed, and the appellate decision came out in early 86, and Tupper was supposed to report to jail, you know, in early 86, and that was just at the same time that James's book was going to be released by Tupper. So, you know, Tupper ultimately fled rather than go to jail. And I think one of the reasons is that he was convinced that if he did go to jail, he'd be, you know, his life was in danger. So while he did get the book out, and while there was, it did reveal James's story, because of what Tupper did, Tennessee Waltz didn't get much circulation. It got some, but not enough. So people really didn't hear the story of James Earl Ray because of the, you know, these circumstances, unfortunate circumstances. Well, about the same time or shortly thereafter, that's when old William Pepper decides to climb on board and start doing something for James. And one of the things that he did was, as he started going out, you know, he re-examined the government's case, found the holes in it. And then he started digging around and talking to various witnesses. He learned you know, the gun that was supposed to be the murder weapon that killed King had never really been tested. He found out that the state's witness that was allegedly going to identify James as being the guy that was in the bathroom of this cheap boarding house, that James was the man that opened the bathroom window out the backside of this boarding house and stuck a gun out it and waited for King to step out on the second floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel so that he could be shot. You know, that's the state's position.
Uh-huh.
You know, this chief witness against James, even though he said all that, he said it because he wanted a reward. But there was a number of witnesses that could testify that this fellow was drunk.
I remember that distinctly, and they did a television program about that within the last year.
Oh, yeah, it was back in 93, and that's part of Tapper was instrumental in that. And
uh-huh.
We'll get into this later on, the next 15 or 20 minutes. But, the more that Tapper started looking around and started seeing holes, he came to the conclusion that, if he'd keep at it, he would uncover some very important things. Now, some of the things that were important, he ultimately determined, the government said that the shot came out of the back of this cheap boarding house from a bathroom window on the second floor. Well, this Wayne Chastain fellow, who's the lawyer now on one of this, back at the time of the King assassination, Wayne was a reporter for one of the Memphis local papers. And Wayne had gone up to that bathroom, and he remembered looking out the bathroom and reached the conclusion that nobody could, from that bathroom window, could see through the trees and the brush in the backyard to pull off a shot at King. And so, that Wayne had always been convinced that it was impossible for the shooting of King to have occurred in the manner in which the government contended. So Pepper and Wayne Chastain, because they both had an interest in this, it was natural that their paths would soon cross, and indeed they did. So, they found out, one of the things they found out was is that, while Wayne had seen the view from the back porch of this, or the bathroom of the second floor of this boarding house, had seen that there was trees that would prevent a clean shot at King. An amazing thing happened the following day after the King assassination. The city of Memphis came along and cleaned out all the brush, all the trees. Well, now, with the trees gone, who would believe that it would be impossible to shoot? That the evidence of impossibility was removed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found out that interesting little tidbit of information. So then they started running across people that, were witnesses of one kind or another that, saw suspicious people lurking around the Lorraine Motel, and some people claimed that they'd seen a guy that was holding a gun in the bushes behind the Lorraine Motel, and then they saw him walk off and jump off of a wall and walk away. And so, there was enough there that if you kept looking over a period of time, if you're just persistent, you're going to build a case. And, of course, that's what Pepper did. Ultimately, Pepper was looking at the owner of Jim's Cafe, this fellow by the name of Lloyd Jowers. Now, Lloyd Jowers was just your average type of guy, and all he did is he had two, greasy spoons, so to speak, just cheap little restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the Jim's Grill, which was on the property adjoining the Lorraine Motel. Soon, Pepper came to the conclusion that somehow, some way, Lloyd Jowers was involved in all of this. So he ultimately determined that Jowers had some waitresses, even though Jowers denied it. There were some eight waitresses that worked for Jowers, and they had worked for him on that day. And ultimately, Pepper was able to locate some of these, and some of them said, "Hey, man, something real suspicious happened that day. We don't know at all, but there was some real suspicious shenanigans going on with old Lloyd Jowers. There's a bunch of shady people that came into the restaurant, and he was in and out and doing all sorts of things." And so it looked like old Lloyd Jowers was involved in this thing. And then Pepper ran across a man that drove a cab and used to frequent Jim's Grill quite often and used to talk to this Lloyd Jowers fella. And he contended that on the day after the King assassination, Lloyd Giles had showed to him a gun that was being kept underneath the counter at the Jim's Grill. And Giles told him that he had found this gun and it looked like the murder weapon, and he picked it up right after the King assassination back behind the his cafe. And so now you've got a little lead in to indicating that, hey, this Lloyd Giles fellow knows a lot more about what went on than, you know, he's not Lily White. He's got something to cover up. He knows something.
He's also not the smartest guy in the world.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Well, either fortunately or unfortunately, you know, I don't know how to characterize it, but Giles was, at the time of the King assassination, he was carrying on an affair with one of his waitresses. Now, maybe it's unfortunate for him, unfortunate for us, I don't know which. But in any event, Pepper soon found this lady, Betty. And he ultimately made a lot of promises to her and tried to protect her and everything else like that. And she indicated to him that she...
So beautiful, for faith the sky, for amber waves of grace, for purple mountain majesties.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you appreciate the hour of the time and the information that is delivered to you each night, Monday through Friday, worldwide, where we are speaking to the world, and the message very clearly is, if Americans lose their freedoms, so goes the world. Wherever you are listening to this broadcast, understand that we are the last really, truly free people upon the face of this earth who own and possess the means to protect ourselves, our property, and our freedoms. And if we lose this, you lose any hope that you've ever had to live free upon this earth. The Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. These people have stuck with this broadcast and with the message of the Hour of the Time since the beginning. They have never wavered. Even when WWCR was burned to the ground, after that very night, I had warned the American people that unless we stopped the debacle that was happening in Waco, Texas, all of those people in that church known as Branch Davidian would be murdered. Now, most sponsors would have run for the hills when they saw the radio station that aired that broadcast burned to the ground the very same night that that statement was uttered. And it was very clearly arson, ladies and gentlemen. But Swiss America Trading didn't do that. They had us back on the air, on WRNO in New Orleans, within 24 hours. They have taken some pretty big heat because of this broadcast and the controversy that's involved here. After all, this is the radio program that was mentioned in the White House memo that Rush Limbaugh read on the air as the most dangerous broadcast in America. Why? Because we tell the truth. We not only tell the truth, but we document it and source it so that you can find that truth also. And therefore, nobody can steer you in the wrong direction. Swiss America Trading specializes in non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets, real money, as defined in the Constitution and in the law. Soon, ladies and gentlemen, there is going to be a breakdown of the very primary structure upon which our society rests. It always happens when socialists take control of a nation. We are engaged in a battle for our future, for our freedom, and for the lives of our children.
grandchildren and their children and grandchildren. Make no mistake about it. When this occurs, you're going to have some real money, because if you don't have it, you're going to be in a big world of hurt. So call Swiss America Trading now at 1-800-289-2646. Thank them for sponsoring this broadcast. Tell them you're a steady listener to the Hour of the Time and that William Cooper sent you. You'll get red carpet treatment. I guarantee it. Ask them how you can get your hands on some real money. And folks, if you're looking for some dream investment where you're going to put some money into some gold coins or some silver coins and walk away with a whole bunch of money in a few months or a few years, forget it. That's not why I'm steering you there. I want to help you protect what you already have and be able to survive what's coming in the future. So don't mistake my message. 1-800-289-2646. Do it now. You'll be glad that you did. 1-800-289-2646. Welcome back to the Hour of the Time, Mr. B. Kraft. Would you like to pick up and continue where you left off?
Well, Tapper was getting to the girlfriend of Lloyd Jowers, and he knew that she had a real important story, and while she wouldn't sign a real affidavit about what was going on, Tapper picked up on what her story was, you know, that she could pinpoint that Lloyd Jowers had a role, the assassination of Martin Luther King. And if Lloyd Jowers had a role in the assassination of King, James Earl Ray was innocent. So what Pepper did is, you know, he knew that James had always wanted to have a real trial. And he contacted a movie production company over in London, England, and persuaded them to provide the funds for a, you know, in essence, a real trial of the case of James Earl Ray. They would go out and they would hire a real prosecutor. And of course they did. They hired Hickman Ewing, who was the former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Tennessee. Hickman Ewing, incidentally, is now working with Star over in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we know the results of that most recent victory, I guess, for the American people.
I think that surprised a lot of people.
Yeah.
Me included.
Yeah, well, I think there's a real battle that's going on there. You know, I think Clinton was counting on his old boy network to protect him and his buddies, and that didn't work.
I'm sure of it. Let's get back to Ray.
So, Hickman Ewing was hired to be the prosecutor, and the company was going to provide him with the funds to bring in experts, to hire investigators, to help present the government's case. And, of course, naturally, the state of Tennessee was going to work very closely with Hickman Ewing. He had virtually everything that they had access to. But then the production company was going to also fund the defense and provide them with money for investigators and, travel and stuff like that. So that was set up, and they were even going to bring in a real judge. You know, they did bring in a real judge. They hired some retired judge, federal judge out of, New York, to come in and sit on the case. So the only thing that was different about this case was the fact that it just simply didn't have the sanction of the state, and it didn't occur in a real, quote, state courtroom. But nonetheless, it was fought for all practical purposes as a real case. So once that agreement was achieved, And the production company was funding this project. What they wanted to do was to film the trial. And they were going to ultimately, the agreement was they'd film the trial, and then they'd let the jury go deliberate, and they would obtain the verdict of the jury. But then it wouldn't be revealed until a certain select night, and that would be April the 4th of 1993, 25 years after King was assassinated, the 25th anniversary of that. And that was the plan. So, you know, that's the way it came off. But during the course of that investigation, a lot more information came out. Pepper was unable to travel a lot more. He was able to hire some investigators to do some running around to find out some very interesting things. And, of course, ultimately, back in, I think it'd be January and February of 93, they did have this mock trial. James had to testify from jail, and they did it with a camera. He couldn't come into the courtroom, but, you know, he was always present in the courtroom because of a video setup. But James testified. The government presented their case. The defense presented their case, which included James testifying. You know, they brought in a lot of people to testify about all the suspicious circumstances. You know, that James wasn't there and that there looked like that there were other people that were involved. But nonetheless, you know, when the jury went out after all this was over with, none of the participants knew what the verdict was. And only when they aired it on April the 4th of 1993 did we ultimately learn what the verdict of that mock trial was. And it was a verdict of not guilty. So James had gotten his real trial, as close to a real trial as he could get. It was presented by experts, you know, the good lawyers on both sides. You know, one was a government lawyer of the highest caliber,
uh-huh.
And you know, we know what he can do. He can convict Clinton's buddies. That's what he just did, Hickman Ewing. So now, as a result of all of that, you know, that gave a boost to the supporters for James Earl Ray to have a mock trial result in an acquittal of James Earl Ray. But now things begin to get a little bit more interesting. A friend of Pepper's had always indicated that there were some people down in Latin America that had a story to tell that was real important. They're related to the James Earl Ray case. But they feared for their lives. And so only through much coaxing, only through these guys being able to see what Pepper could and would do, did Pepper acquire their confidence. And so here's the story that these guys revealed to Pepper. Now, you can read the book. All of this is in there. But the, you know, Pepper is continuing to protect these two gentlemen because some of their associates that, you know, participated in the same things that they did have been bumped off. And so naturally they fear for their lives, and for that reason, their names have been held in confidence, so they'll have an alias in the book. But this is the story that these guys revealed, that the government was real fearful of the King movement. It took a lot of precautions. It did a lot of snooping around. It did a lot of eavesdropping. It did a lot of tailing. You know, it closely watched King while he was building up his civil rights movement. But when King got involved in championing the cause of the Vietnam War, that's when things kind of came unglued in Washington, D.C. And so the powers that be found that they would benefit if King were eliminated from the picture. So what they did is that they did such things as this team of sharpshooters from the Army were trained in Pocatello, Idaho. And these teams would divide up into three groups. And the three groups would pick a target. You know, let's say that you're out in the middle of a field and you're going to do some sharpshooting, and, you know, you got a space of 1,000 yards between you and these other people that are shooting at the same target. The whole purpose of all this is to have three teams focused in on one target and pull it off so that, you know, things click. So they practice using three teams. this particular group of teams was sent, after they did this training, they were sent around to follow and tail various civil rights leaders. And one team, at one point in time, I forgot the particular place where this occurred, but one team came real close to shooting Martin Luther King. One of the participants said, "I had King in my crosshairs for a body hit." And, of course, King, you know, he didn't pull the trigger just right then, and somebody else came into the line of vision, so King wasn't shot on that time. But then, ultimately, the government did show up on April 4th, 1968. This team came out of Camp Shelby in Mississippi. They got up early in the morning. They drove up to Memphis, Tennessee, got into downtown Tennessee, and then about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, two teams were stationed in two different spots in the immediate vicinity of the Lorraine Motel. One team was located on top of a tall building. It's a railroad building, you know, say within 500 or 1,000 yards of the Lorraine Motel. You know, just some, you know, within shooting distance.
Sure.
The hotel. I can't gauge distances, you know.
Well, most people can't.
Right. but they were on the roof, and they had a leader for each group. And they would communicate by means of walkie-talkie, and so somebody would be constantly looking at King to come out of the hotel. And the sharpshooters, one was stationed on top of this eight-story building, and another one was stationed inside of a water tower, also in the same vicinity. But you might ask, you know, gee, that's only two groups, and it takes three to be a team.
And here comes Raul.
Right, right. It all falls into place.
It sure does, especially since Raul has been named as being involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. This is what these fellows down in Latin America who fear for their lives say. They were on the roofs. They had orders to kill. And that's where Pepper gets the name of his book. They were stationed there, and they had orders to shoot Martin Luther King and Andrew Young. And they were to do it at any moment they stepped out of the hotel to do something like get into a car or whatever. You know, it was very fortunate that King, on the occasion when he got shot, just happened to step out on the balcony and stand there for a long period of time. But these guys had King and Young in their scope, and they were sitting there waiting for the orders to kill to come over the walkie-talkie. But then some other shot rang out, and King fell. So the third member of the group was successful, bringing down King. And so the government had a direct involvement in all of this. Pepper's ultimate conclusion is that a hit team like this that has three prongs, so to speak, the government only sent two prongs on this occasion. Well, it takes three to tango in this instance. Well, the government had contractually arranged through a private intermediary, Pepper contends it's the mob, and he can prove it. The mob went out and hired the third man, and that third man was Raul.
And why would the mob have an interest in killing Martin Luther King?
Well, Pepper can show government agents talking to. Pepper located the driver of Joey Bonanno or something like that. You know, one of those New York mobster types. This driver confirms that he drove. You know, this guy's still alive today. He's got religion. So he spilled the beans to Pepper that he drove one of these mob bosses to a meeting in upstate New York where they met with a bunch of government types that promised to pay him big bucks to eliminate King.
Well, that's...
It all falls into place.
Yeah, it's not a surprise. What I was fishing for was the relationship between the intelligence community and the mafia going back to actually before World War II.
Well...
They've done many things.
I don't think there's been any, quote, relationship. I think it's a marriage. I think the mafia took over the government. Is that your view?
Well,
the way they operate is identical. You know, I always judge somebody by their actions. If the mob does something a certain way, and if the government does it the same way, I think they're all mob operations.
Well, they are, but it's a different kind of a mob to which they all belong.
Yeah.
But you're right about the marriage, and that's been going on for an awfully long time. Not only between the intelligence community and the mob. But in Europe, there was a relationship between the mob, the Vatican, and the P2 Lodge, Propaganda 2. And these nefarious relationships and connections between the underworld and supposedly legitimate government organizations is what throws a lot of people completely off the track when they go looking for these things, and they attribute certain deeds to people who probably were involved, but that's not where the ultimate blame really lies. And that's a big problem, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, I think for your listeners, I think one of the things that needs to be done, this book that William Pepper has, you know, I'm just championing the cause. You know, I'm interested in James. I like him. You know, he's just a cheap crook, I guess. But, you know, what he's been, you know, he's an important national figure. And he's important in the sense that he was set up.
Yes.
And now William Pepper can prove it in his book called Orders to Kill.
Uh-huh.
And he's got everything documented. It's kind of a lengthy book. But I would think that a lot of your listening audience would benefit by getting this book. It's going to be an education. And once they get educated about this particular matter, we need to, you know, increase the public awareness of the government's involvement in this. And once you get people acclimated to, you know, this kind of a thinking in terms that the government can do this, then they will be receptive to other similar operations, and they can see them. Let me give you one example. Are we not seeing at the present time a spate of burnings of black churches?
Yes.
You know, this happened in the past.
Uh-huh.
It happened here in Alabama. It's called the Birmingham Church Bombings back in the early 60s. Do you know, we can, for something like the Oklahoma bombing, we can arrest within 48 hours the culprit. I mean, not just, you know, a hit and miss. I mean, absolutely, first thing out of the chute, arrest the guy within 48 hours. Yet for the Birmingham church bombings, there was never anybody that was prosecuted and convicted for the church bombings back in... And, of course, the same thing's happening right now.
But you told me today that there was one arrest.
Yes. And there was one conviction, but it was not for the bombing. Okay. And I think that once I tell you the circumstances of this case, it adds a whole lot of credence. It generally points the finger in the right direction of who is really behind the Birmingham church bombings of 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
The one arrest, prosecution, and conviction that was related to these cases was a black man. That black man saw some law enforcement officers toss a Molotov cocktail or some type of a bomb into a black church. And he picked up the phone and called the cops.
And that was...
And he was arrested. Tried. And convicted for the reprehensible crime of filing a false government report.
Which, of course...
doesn't that say too much?
Yes. And it says an awful lot. It says too much, in fact.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot that's happened in America. There is a lot that will happen in the future. And people need to become... receptive to aware of some of these little facts and some of these little events that help point the finger in the direction of who is really pulling off these events.
Yeah.
But we've got to increase public awareness about the situation involving James Earl Ray. And once that happens, I think we'll be entering into the next level of the battle against the government. The government in our country that is running roughshod over everybody that wants to reduce us to a bunch of slaves.
Yes, they do. Not only that, they want to destroy this country and create something bigger, of which this will just be a small part.
Oh, yeah.
And
eliminate a lot of the population, too.
Yes, that's one of their goals.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very clear about that. They don't hide any of this. And that's the worst thing about it, in my estimation, is that none of this is hidden for anybody who really wants to do the research and look. And it doesn't really take a whole lot of effort. But it does require that people get up off the couch and at least march down to their library once or twice a month.
Right.
Or like order Dr. Pepper's book and many other things. And that's very difficult for some reason for some people to do. And that's got to change, Larry. And how do we get these people to change those kinds of habits?
How do we get them to change? I don't know. That's the secret I'm looking for. But this I do know. There's too many American men that don't have any guts. There's too many American men that have a yellow streak down their back a mile wide.
By golly, I'm so happy to hear you say that.
Oh, I mean, that's sad state of affairs.
Yes, it is.
But let me just tell you, if you can read Pepper's book, and let me just tell you, there's a parallel between the civil rights movement and what we're going through. And if we don't learn the lessons of the civil rights movement, they were effective. They had the government quaking in their boots. And we can do it too.
Yeah.
And all it's going to take is people that are willing to stand up. It doesn't take a hero. You don't have to be trained to be, some Superman to do it. All you have to do is say, I've had enough and I want to reclaim my country. And we need more people that are willing to get up off of turn the boob tube off and get up and stand for America. I want us to go out to America and have our message so persuasive, so true, so intriguing. And we go out there with such a missionary zeal that within the next couple of years, we bring the great body of the American people over to our side. We can do it.
We have to do it, Larry, because 2 years is about all the time that we're going to have to do it.
Right.
And if we haven't accomplished something major during that time, I'm very, very fearful for my children and grandchildren.
Me too. So you started off the show. I think you had your daughter on.
Yes.
All right, I have a girl that'll be Christian. She'll be 8 in the morning. So I just wanted to bring that up. I wanted to tell her in the morning. I said her name over the radio.
Well, that's wonderful. Pooh will be 6 in the morning. So we'll celebrate for yours, too.
Good. Yours is 6 in the morning?
Yes.
Oh, hey, that's interesting.
That's why I said tomorrow's her day. She has to go get some sleep.
Okay, good.
Well,
Bill, it's been a pleasure to be on your show.
And I certainly thank you very much, and you're an eloquent storyteller. And unfortunately, this story is true. And folks, within the next few broadcasts, I'm going to read you verbatim these transcripts. The transcript of the preliminary statement filed by James Earl Ray and his legal counsel, and also the answer, the response of defendant Raoul Blank.
Well, that's just one of them.
Yeah.
When I was over there, Bill, I just saw that and said, hey, out of the ones I just picked, I said, I want one with Raoul Blank on it. So you're just getting a snapshot there with that one.
Well, great. It's a lot. Wait till you hear it, folks. Good night. And God bless each and every single one of you.
It
Tomorrow all the things were gone, worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that.